You're listening to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. This episode is called Christianity Today. We'll hear from journalist and author Greg Sheridan, whose new book, God is Good for You, makes a case for the achievements of Christianity. In this conversation, recorded live on Tuesday, October 2nd, 2018, Greg speaks with Fifth Estate host Sally Warhaft about the evolving place of faith in Australian society and across the globe.
It's a pleasure tonight to have Greg Sheridan here as a spotlight interview. He's been a friend of this series for all the years that we've been doing it, but it's the first time that he's had the hot seat on his own and to talk about a subject that we haven't talked enough about in this particular series. Greg, of course, is the foreign editor of The Australian. He's been a journalist for 40 years?
40 years, yeah.
And the author of numerous books, but the one we're here to discuss tonight is God is Good for You, A Defence of Christianity in Troubled Times. And readings will be selling it after the event. A book that was launched by the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who we will have a chat about a bit later on. But just please, for now, welcome Greg Sheridan.
Thanks, Sally. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
There is so much love and joy and devotion in reading the book that you've written. Was it a pleasure to write it, Greg? Was it sort of always in you, this book?
Well, Sally, it's kind of you to say, and it's wonderful to be here. It was, I think. It was great fun to write. It was a neurotic pleasure. I'm a very, very neurotic writer, and I can't write unless there's a terrible deadline and I'm a long way behind, you know. And I wrote it really in about... I researched and read it for a couple of years, but I wrote it really in about 2 months. And I was a very difficult person for the family to live with during that time, because I'd run out of the study and say, do you realise the debt that Thomas Aquinas owed to Moses Maimonides? You can't believe it. And, you know, the family thought I was even stranger than usual. And then I'd work for 12 hours and then I'd go for an hour's walk to just walk it out of me. But it was enormous fun.
Tell us a little bit about your own personal faith, just to give a context for the audience as we go into our discussion.
Well, Sally, I have always been a kind of believing Christian, but and I think I'm quite a low-class person, because I don't have any difficulty with belief. You know, was it Pasteur or someone said, give me the faith of a Breton peasant? Well, I'm your Breton peasant, you know. But I have enormous trouble with practice. Living up to the belief is hugely difficult and problematic, and I drift in and out of it and away from it and closer to it and so on. But I'd have to say, always said some prayers every day, and so it's always been with me, and I've often wanted to talk and write about it, and I think it's a good story. So, you know, journalism is a search for good material forever, and you know, so part of the impulse to write about it was just the sense this is actually a good story.
I think you've described yourself, you married a Sikh, of course, decades ago, and raised three Sikh sons. And you describe yourself as the pro-Sikh faction of Catholicism.
Absolutely, absolutely. So this book is very pro-Jewish. As you know, there's a lot about the Jewish scriptures, and it's also pro-Sikh. And you ask, why do the Sikhs end up in this book about Christianity? Well, I'd be pretty stupid if they didn't, wouldn't I, really? And let me tell you, the Sikhs are very warlike people, and you don't want to cross them. But Sikhism is really a wonderful religion. It's a monotheistic religion, I think, deeply attached to the natural law, with a lovely tradition of mysticism. So my wife and our three boys, they don't mind me saying this, the boys came to me when they were very young. They're from her first marriage. So they were Sikhs when they came to me. And they went to my old Christian Brothers school. One of them became school captain. One of them won the Religious Knowledge Prize. I don't know that there are that many Sikhs who've won the Religious Knowledge Prize at Christian Brothers schools. But we're not confused about our respective identities. I mean, I'm a Catholic who likes to go to the Sikh temple, and my wife and boys are Sikhs who sometimes come to the church with me.
Bring your mic in just a tiny bit. It just looks a bit far. You write, there's a lovely line in your book, the resting place of the mind, its natural equilibrium, as it were, is belief. Talk to us a little bit about what that means.
Well, Sally, I try to write this book. So the book is in two halves. First is about Christianity and the second is about Christians who I find, you know, particularly inspiring or interesting or signs of new life. And the backdrop to the book is that there's a huge decline in attachment to Christianity in the West, in Western Europe and Australia and New Zealand and North America, making us very eccentric civilization amongst human civilizations. The rest of the world is on fire with religion, and the vast majority of human beings who have ever lived on this planet have believed in God. But the only slightly rebarbative or combative element of the book is really a response to the new atheists, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and so on. And when I came to write that chapter, I wanted to write a positive argument for belief at the rational level and only deal a little bit with the negative business of rebutting the new atheists. But of course, belief itself is not really a matter of the intellect, it's really a matter of the will. It's what you choose to believe. And all belief, even all rational belief, tends to be a matter of faith. So I believe I'm the son of my mum and dad because they told me so. So I have faith in them. I've got no objective proof of it. I didn't take a swab of their DNA before they died. And so it's a justified belief. It's a rational belief, but it's not a proven belief. So I believe belief in God is rational, justified, reasonable. I don't think it's proven, because if it was proven, you wouldn't need faith. So I don't think you prove God or you disprove God. But that chapter tries to establish that it's perfectly rational and easy to believe in God. And in fact, the alternative of atheism requires really extraordinary magical thinking. I mean, one thing you have to confront, for example, is the unlikeliness of our universe and the unlikeliness of life and how statistically improbable it all is. Now, a thing can be improbable but still happen. But one atheist response to that is to say, well, perhaps we just have an infinite number of universes and we lucked into the one that is suitable for life. And when I read this in Richard Dawkins, I thought to myself, so you can't believe in God, which almost every human being in the history of humanity has believed in, but you can believe in an infinite number of universes? And I thought, that is more unreasonable and requires a greater leap of faith than anything involved in conventional belief in God.
One of the many reasons I wanted to talk to you about this tonight is that it's very clear to everyone, I think, that Christianity in Australia is in a moment, and it's quite sort of hard to put your finger on. There's several things swimming around at the moment about why it might be a more difficult time to be Christian in Australia than in previous times. The subtitle of your book, A Defence of Christianity in Troubled Times, was there a particular moment when in your life when you thought this has changed, being a Christian and the way you perceived being a Christian in our society has changed?
I think so, Sally, but I think it was probably more gradual, although I will offer one particular moment. But so I've been a journalist, as you rightly observed, for 40 years, demonstrating my extremely aged nature. But when I started in journalism, there was a bit of an Australian secular settlement that we Catholics and Protestants didn't talk about religion too much because we were always arguing, and that was one of the bitter divisions in Australian society. So we all shut up about it a bit. And I kind of observed that secular discipline for a long time. Not only that, it's kind of unbecoming for a journalist to talk about God. I mean, it just shows how broad-minded God is that he'd put up with being talked about by a journalist. And no one could lead more rackety lives in principle than journalism. Our lives are dedicated to irregularity, crisis, chaos, you know, dissolution. But over the years, I saw the culture become kind of indifferent to Christianity and then hostile to it. Now, I don't want to exaggerate that. Christians are not persecuted in Australia or anything like that. They are persecuted in a lot of parts of the world. They're certainly not persecuted in Australia. And to give you the particular moment, 3 years ago I had a different book out and I went to lots and lots of writers' festivals, Melbourne Writers' Festival, Sydney Writers' Festival, Byron Bay, Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And in all hundreds of books that I saw at those festivals, there was not a single one written from either a pro-Christian or a pro-Jewish point of view. And I thought, but Judaism and Christianity together, although Christianity is a universal religion and most Christians today in the world are not Westerners, nonetheless, Judaism and Christianity together provide all of the structure of Western civilization. And imagine not knowing anything about it. Imagine sending kids to school and depriving them of the fun of the Old Testament. The book of Jonah gets swallowed by a whale. It's like a Mel Brooks comedy. It's the best. Written, I have to say, more in the style of the Herald Sun than the Australian, but great sub-editors, all the names, fantastic story. Jonah is a terrific sook. He can't bear that he has to be nice to the people of Nineveh. This is such great stuff. And I thought, you know, a tiny little contribution this book can make is to be a soupçon, just a soupçon of knowledge in the great ocean of discourse. And maybe I have an ambition that people might read it and say, well, that Sheridan is an idiot, but by God, that fellow he quotes from the third century, Tertullian or Tim Keller, the Presbyterian, they're worth following up. I'd like to read those books.
They're two different things, though, to strive for a society, and one that I would strive for, where Western civilization is taught. I'm so sympathetic to that. To me, it just seems obvious, as much as other histories. In fact, to some degree, more when you've got to understand your own society first, probably before you look to others. But that's a very different thing to religious instruction, isn't it? And there's often a blur in that, in what I think in perceptions of what people are really wanting and asking for. I mean, if we had a society where there were very, very few practicing Christians, but every young person had a gold standard education in Western civilization and all the other important things that should be learned, how would you feel about that?
Well, that's a very acute observation, Sally, and a challenging question. So my book argues two separate propositions, not, I hope, trying to sneak one in under the guise of the other, but I do make an argument for cultural literacy and that needs an understanding of, the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, the New Testament, and the whole Christian tradition. There's a chapter in which I try to rehabilitate the Middle Ages. Of course, the Middle Ages have been defamed as a period of shocking superstition and priestly rule and so forth. And I rely heavily on the work of a magnificent Oxford scholar, Larry Siddontop, who argues that it was really in the Middle Ages that the West invented the idea of the individual and everything that goes with it, human conscience, human rights, feminism, human dignity, democracy, a secular government, everything. This all happened in the Middle Ages, which are caricatured as a time of terrible darkness. And of course, you read the great texts of the Middle Ages, like Dante's Divine Comedy, it's a fabulous critique of the corruption of medieval Christianity. It puts Pope Boniface in the eighth circle of hell. I mean, this is not what you'd call a sort of a papal PR job. But then, so that's one proposition, cultural literacy. But then I do also believe Christianity is true. So I think it's good for people to know about it, whether they think it's true or not. I think that would be an element of cultural literacy. But, you know, let me not bury the lead. I'll tell you I think it's true as well. And I think partly our culture tries to bluff Christians out of their belief a bit, to say, look, no sensible person believes this anymore. It's all just superstition. No scientist believes in Christianity. Whereas, of course, you know, fantastically eminent scientists do. So I think, I just offer my you know, puny arguments about that or recount the beliefs of other Christians. But they are two separate things, I agree.
I'm Jewish, but not practicing. But I'm somebody, I think, I'm going to quote you here, because I absolutely do believe there is more to it than what is before our eyes. I deeply believe it. And I'm deeply interested in all of the scriptures. But you talk about what about the growing number who believe in a spiritual or sacred power, but not the traditional ones. And I'll quote you. You ask if this state is some sort of halfway house from which they, or somebody like me, might one day re-enter the home of belief or a waiting room for admission to the chamber of atheism. And there is a condescension in that, that to not believe in a God or an almighty God or is somehow not as whole or a life that can't be as well lived as a more obvious or traditional track. Is that an unfair reading?
Well, it's not the impression I meant to convey, certainly. So I think I do say somewhere, but certainly let me say it now. You know, when you write in as neurotic a fashion as I do, there are sometimes some loose ends, but I certainly believe atheists can live as nobly as any Christian. And I have a chapter on the crimes of Christianity where I confront all the wicked things, well, not all, I mean, it's just one book, but I confront in principle the wickedness that Christians have often done. And being Christian doesn't solve the problems of the human condition. You know, there are, whatever it is, 2.5 billion Christians in the world, and I would think they range from having committed the most heinous acts of evil to living the lives of most heroic virtue. But I didn't mean to suggest that someone... So I don't want to judge anyone's life except by their deeds, and even then I don't judge their life, I just judge their deeds. You can have whatever spiritual arrangement works for you, from atheism through, you know, deism or anything you like. What I was trying to analyse, though, was how many Christians are there and who is a Christian? So some Christians don't like to hear the bad news of their decline in numbers, and they'll say to you, but, you know, really, the society is full of Christians because people still acknowledge a higher being or something. But when you investigate the data through the work of the sociologists, I think you have to take people at face value when they say, I don't believe in God. So all I'm trying to do is... quantitative questions are very messy at the edges. So something like 15% of people are more or less practicing Christians, if you define practicing by going to church. Lots of people don't go to church and are magnificent Christians. Lots of people are magnificent people and they're not Christians. But all of that stuff was really just trying to work out a taxonomy of where we are.
It's not just a loss of faith in religions that we're seeing, you know, in countries, obviously Australia, it's institutions, it's politics, it's humanity itself for lots of people. This decline of the idea of the sacred generally, I sense. How does that fit with the more specific decline of people going to church and being... observant?
Well, the causal connection, I would imagine, is very multifaceted and potentially quite complex. But in my simple-minded journalistic way, I do think that a loss of belief in the transcendent leads to a troubled society. So human beings are formed in a culture, and a culture without God, I think, will form different human beings from the human beings that are formed in a culture with God. Now, if we believe that human beings in the end are nothing more than a chancy outcrop of the biosphere, you have to ask yourself, well, why do human beings have any greater claim on our consideration than a cockroach? The atheist philosopher Peter Singer is a very, very fine person, a very fine philosopher, and I've got great admiration for him, and he's a very useful philosopher because he takes ideas to their logical end. he and I were on a Q&A episode recently, and I quoted back to him a passage he'd written in a book famously, in which he said that, you know, profoundly handicapped children, if their parents don't want them, should be left to die. And I asked him if he, you know, still held this, and he said, yes, I do. He said, and in the book he argues that they have a kind of a lower status than other sentient mammals. And he said to me, but surely, Greg, you don't think just because they're a member of our species that they deserve special consideration? And I said, yes, that's exactly what I think. They are human beings and they deserve special consideration. Now, through the history of our culture, that special consideration has come from the idea of each human being having a special relationship with the Creator. The most radical pro-human rights statement in the ancient world came in the book of Genesis. And getting deeply involved with the Old Testament was such a joy in this book. And in this book of Genesis, the writers tell us God created humanity in his own image. That was a radically pro-human rights statement in the context of the ancient world, and it sustains human rights today. Now, the question is, can a society which completely, utterly cuts itself off from the roots of its values sustain those values? Now, I would argue for a long time you live off the moral capital of your inheritance. But in the end, so I think eventually we'll create a society which is not post-Christian but pre-Christian. And will that sustain the civil values of human rights that we all love? I think it will be challenging.
Let's talk about our politicians and our parliament for a while, because one of the really interesting things you know, in fact, it's Christina Keneally who you've interviewed, I think, 14 prominent, or not all of them, incredibly well known, but there's 14 really serious interviews in the book of politicians and who are practicing, and Christina Keneally is one of them. And she talks about how in the parliament today there's a higher proportion of practicing Christians in the parliament than there is in the general population. I would argue that, as in many things in Australian life in recent times, society is actually leading way ahead in terms of displaying Christian virtues, whether they be of just general fairly, you know, decent decorum and behaviour amongst each other, to more obvious things like the idea of welcoming the stranger. How is it that we've got this high number of supposedly, people that are, some of them really pushing their Christian ideas, and yet not seeming to show the virtues that are most commonly associated with it?
Well, again, I didn't want to make adverse judgments about anyone, certainly not anyone that I interviewed in the book. So I didn't say to them, look, I find your policies. You know, I was interviewed by a Sydney radio presenter and he said, how can you call someone a Christian who doesn't give decent drought relief? And I said, well, you know, it's not really up to me to say that they're fake Christians because I don't agree with their policies. And I don't think really Christianity adjudicates between centre-left and centre-right policies at all. You know, you might want to help human welfare by strengthening trade union rights so that workers have better conditions, or you might want to strengthen human welfare by deregulating the labour market so that more people get jobs. Well, I don't think you can claim that either of those policies is Christian. And all of these politicians were very reluctant to do the interviews. I tell you, Brexit was a walk in the park compared with getting Malcolm Turnbull or Bill Shorten to do these interviews. And there were many occasions where I said, look, you've got to do it by Monday or I can't get it in the book. And they'd ring me on Tuesday and say, oh, sorry, mate, we just missed. And I'd say, that's OK, we can do it Wednesday. And as a very experienced interviewer, Sally, you'd know all about this process. And I was impressed. Now, I would say that none of them really makes a big deal. A couple of them are public Christians, Kevin Rudd, Tony Abbott and Mike Baird. I'd say none of the others was a public Christian, and even those three don't try to make Christianity a part of their political agenda, but it's just that that's the way they've been presented in their identity. But I was profoundly impressed. So they range from Penny Wong on the left of the Labor Party to Andrew Hastie at the conservative end of the Liberal Party. And I was impressed with all 14 of them by the depth of the thought that they'd given to the matter and by the amount that they knew. I mean, Malcolm Turnbull was a revelation about the stuff that he just knew off the top of his head. And so I judge them politically all the time, but I'm not going to judge their souls, and I'm grateful to them for doing the interview.
They're fascinating insights into all of them. I mean, there's a lot of similarities in their answers. My sense was you asked them all the same questions. Is that...
More or less.
Yeah. And there is a lot of similarity, but it does feel very genuine and ginger, you know, a bit tentative in the responses. And I mean, they all, every one of them engaged in regular prayer. Now, let's start with Penny Wong, because I think a few people that I've mentioned this to, as her being one of the interviews, have been really, oh, Penny Wong's a Christian, as if at this point in cultural time, somebody on the left of the Labor Party with very progressive instincts and policies and ideas couldn't possibly be a practicing Christian, and which I find quite unbelievable and pretty offensive, that somehow Christianity is the preserve of, the right or something else. Have you found that too in people's reactions?
Yes, I think that's right. And I certainly wanted to add my tuppence worth to say that Christianity is not the preserve of social conservatives or social liberals. It's quite reasonable for people to say, I believe this policy best reflects Christian values or something. If they want to say that, that's okay. But, you know, Kim Beazley was very ardent that you must never claim a Christian warrant for your policy, because your policy doesn't have sacred endorsement. You're just doing the best you can. But let me have 7 seconds on Penny Wong. I think Penny Wong is an outstanding person. I'm very impressed with her as a politician and as a person. I had a nefarious subtext with these interviews, which I think was pretty obvious to everyone, which is just to say, here are these people who kind of run our country. They're immensely talented and clever and accomplished. And guess what? They have this enormous hinterland of belief. Now, I don't want them to become like American politicians where they wear their religion on their sleeve all the time, but it struck me as a very big part of their lives which generally wasn't talked about. And my nefarious subtext was, if all of them believe this, maybe it's not inherently so stupid. But I must admit, you know, Penny shouldn't have to wear this interview like an albatross or anything.
But
talking her into doing it took quite a lot of work, and it's the only time she's a very poised person, a very, self-aware and self-confident, and I really did feel like I was a dentist inflicting terrible pain on her. Not because she's uncomfortable with her own beliefs, but because she just doesn't do this stuff in public. She's not secret about it. There's nothing, it's all on the record. She's referred to it in the Senate. She attends, she's a member of the Uniting Church, and she, you know, sponsored some events of theirs in Parliament House and so on. But of course, you know, and there are some personal elements to her interview. And so I was very grateful for her to do it. And of course, a final comment, the left traditionally had a great Christian inheritance. I mean, John Wesley, the rights of workers, Clement Attlee used to talk about the spiritual dimension of socialism. Pope Leo XIII's encyclical, Rerum Novarum, which was all about the rights of trade unions and workers and so on. Nor, though, would I swing the other way and say that's the only possible political interpretation of Christian values.
To respond to the remarks you just made about, you know, these very clever, masterful politicians that also are practising or observant in some way of their Christianity, and that this is a sort of, proof of your argument that these two things can...
A demonstration.
We won't get into proof. It could equally be said, though, that, you know, in reply to that, that, I mean, God, you know, is either just laughing at them or has deserted the building when it comes to the shenanigans of the conduct. Again, in the, I mean, I'm just again so surprised that you can have so many people who express, they all express it so movingly in one way or another, their relationship, but it's not being demonstrated.
Well, let me offer you two responses to that, Sally, and it's a serious charge that you make. The first is, I take great consolation in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's observation that the line between good and evil doesn't run between a group of good people over there and a group of evil people over there. Instead, it runs down the centre of every human heart, and every human being every day is in a conflict between the good and evil within them. And I think, on the whole, these politicians try to do good in their lives, but I'm not vouchsafing their conduct, as it were. And the second reflection is, it's precisely because of the reflection you offer, very sensible reflection, that people are so reticent to talk about their beliefs. Not least me, myself. I mean, in one way, it's ludicrous that I'm talking about Christian belief, because for goodness sake, I've been a journalist for 40 years, you know? I mean, you just can't imagine a more rackety life than being a journalist. It's just, I don't want to defame other journalists, but, you know, I mean...
Go on.
What I'm getting at in my awkward way is that I had to confront at some point a threshold which said, it's absolutely terrible if anyone judges Christianity by my life. That would be a disaster. But on the other hand, if I leave the discussion of Christianity only to people who are really morally qualified, it's going to be a very small discussion, you know? So once you jump over that hurdle, that of course you're in danger of, you know, the sort of the Elmer Gantry charge, you know, everybody can look back and say, look at all the mean things you've done in your life. And, you know, I'm glad nobody asked me how much I drank when I was 17 or anything like that. And I think I would just feel the same about all these politicians too. I mean, I think all of them are trying to do good, and, you know, but they're all fallible human beings.
I think it is incredibly sad that individuals feel they can't express that they believe in God if they do, that we're living in a society where people would feel somehow afraid for any reason of saying that. We'll talk briefly about Malcolm Turnbull. I mean, your book is a little bit dated because you didn't interview Scott Morrison. Who's very interesting in himself, his own particular journey of faith. But Malcolm Turnbull was a real surprise to me. He's interesting because he wasn't brought up in a religious family. He got it all himself along the way from school and university. But he prays regularly. He goes to mass pretty regularly. He visits other denominational churches pretty regularly. He has what appears to be a great intellectual interest in religion, but also, and this is what you point out in the book, more than any other politician, that love is the virtue for him that was really important, and that when you pointed it out, he does, and we did, use that word more than any other politician I can think of.
That's true. You know, I tell you a terrible story about ScoMo. I texted ScoMo to ask him if he would be in this book, and he didn't come back to me.
Oh, what month was it? Was he planning something?
No. He was a busy treasurer at that time, and I should have gone properly through his press secretary.
Busier than the Prime Minister?
Well, I didn't follow up. You see, I really followed up very, very energetically with Malcolm. But And one of the reasons I didn't follow up was I felt, you know, I'm a bit overweight for middle-aged white guys from Sydney. And now ScoMo, God bless him, came along to the launch. And the only time you ever get a text from, that I ever you really ever got a complaining text from ScoMo was when I'd write something that he disagreed with theologically. And he'd send me a text saying, no, that's not justified. And so again, there's a booming hinterland there, and I stupidly let it get away. But on Malcolm chose to become a Catholic, and he did acquire religious belief at school. He thought of himself, in various Christian denominational terms, although denominations weren't that important to him. But, you know, he and I were going on Q&A once, and we were having this ridiculous, trivial text exchange beforehand. And he said, oh, it's so depressing, why don't we talk about something else? And I said, yeah, how about medieval theology? And he said, okay, the first one who can mention the Apollinarian heresy gets a bottle of champagne. Now, the Apollinarian heresy, as I'm sure you all know, is an early church heresy which held that Jesus didn't have a human mind. Now, I really thought the Apollinarian heresy would be pretty hard to work into Q&A. So I sent him a text saying, no, let's deal with Duns Scotus, who is a medieval theologian who is famous for the doctrine that Mary was immaculately conceived, that is, she was conceived without sin. And Duns Scotus was known as the subtle doctor. Malcolm knew all about this. Now, he could not possibly have mugged that up to know this while he was texting me in the House of Representatives during question time when he was communications minister. And we duly went on Q&A, and I said the problem with the government is it looks about as easy to understand as Duns Scotus talking about the Immaculate Conception. Malcolm roared with laughter. Everyone else on the panel pretended that they got the joke too, and they all... and he did duly send me a bottle of champagne the next day, so I have to declare that. But Malcolm is a very, very intellectually gifted person. His brain has a lot of rooms, a lot of capacious rooms, and he's very reluctant to do the interview. He launched the book for me. He wouldn't launch the book until he'd read it. He was Prime Minister, but he read the book from cover to cover, gave an immensely thoughtful speech at the launch, was uncomfortable with my questions in the interview. I said to him, well, do you pray? And he said, all right, well, you've asked me. Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. You know, smart aleck. Well, you want to make something of it? But really, I thought his answers were thoughtful. And his comment about love was that he said, poetry is that which can't be translated, and mystery is, religion is inherently a mystery, very much like poetry, which can't be expressed. And he said the heart of Christianity for him is the selfless love of Jesus. And you get near to Christianity when you get near to the selfless love of Jesus. And the people who've inspired him, people who work at the Wayside Chapel and so forth. Again, you couldn't mug that up. That he didn't know what questions I was going to ask him or anything. And this was at the end of a long discussion in which he played a lot of defensive strokes first, you know, about sort of prepared kind of phrases about it. So, yes, I was impressed by Malcolm, as I was by Bill Shorten and all the others.
When you asked Tony Abbott, do you pray, he replied, I say the Hail Mary when the plane takes off. I don't pick up the Bible regularly and read a passage and seek inspiration. I mean, I was surprised at that. I suppose I'd made assumptions about somehow Tony Abbott having a more formalised prayer schedule than Malcolm Turnbull, which, you know, of course goes to show how stupid it is to presume of anybody what their inner life consists of.
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult to interview Tony again because, you know, as lots of people know, Tony was really my best friend at university and we remained very, very good friends, although I was very critical of him at times as Prime Minister. And I never opposed Malcolm on behalf of Tony or anything like that. But it was almost like asking your brother or something, you know. It was more awkward in a sense than it is with the others, you know, and I couldn't kind of really probe him in quite the same way. But I guess, like a lot of Catholics, we didn't grow up reading the Bible that much. I mean, the Catholic form of spirituality typically centres on the Mass and the experience of the Eucharist and so forth. And you certainly pray, but it's probably less Bible-centric. One of the good things about this book, one of the good things about writing this book is that all the old denominational hostilities are gone. So I had a wonderful time with the Pentecostal Planet Shakers. I was greatly inspired by evangelicals in Perth. There's a chapter about an Anglican pastor with a profoundly handicapped son, a guy I find tremendously inspiring. I spent time in Benedictine and Cistercian monasteries. They're all great buddies with each other. Campion College, a predominantly Catholic college in Sydney, is helping a Baptist college to get university accreditation now. So all the denominational hostilities which were around when I was a kid, 50 years ago, 55 years ago, they've all gone now. And that's a good thing, I think.
You spend, obviously, a lot of the book defending Christianity and talking about all the gifts that it's given to Western civilization. You're very clear too that over 2,000 years, Christians have certainly committed terrible crimes. Obviously, in our most recent times, it's the sexual abuse of children from within the church and widespread institutionalized abuse. Tell us, as a practicing Catholic, what that meant to you to discover this, because you write about having no inkling of it throughout your entire childhood and adult life.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm much better as a commentator than an investigative journalist, because I spent all this time in Catholic institutions and honestly had not the faintest hint of it. I was educated by the nuns and the Christian Brothers. I spent a year in a Redemptorist seminary seeing if I could become a priest. I was an altar boy for a couple of years. I've joined so many Catholic youth groups, I couldn't possibly remember them all. I even worked for a few months for the Catholic Weekly in a very early sojourn in journalism. But, you know, Paul Bongiorno, our friend from Channel 10, he lived as a priest in the same presbytery as Gerald Ridsdale, and he had absolutely no idea that Ridsdale was a child abuser. I mean, these are very secretive people whose activities were very secretive. So in my childhood, there was no sense that this was a badly kept secret or anything. And when I found out about it, it was the most shocking and terrible thing I'd ever found out about my church. Now, a couple of points of context only. There's no defence of the church here. The church's management of this issue has been awful, just shocking. So the perpetrators have committed terrible, evil crimes against innocent human beings and deserve the full weight of the law. But then beyond the perpetrators is the administrative response of the church authorities, and that was terrible. That was absolutely terrible. Now, does that make Christianity invalid? I always understood that Christians were prone as anyone else to corruption and to wickedness. And I asked Bill Shorten. So Bill Shorten grew up a Catholic, and his parish priest, it turned out, was a shocking paedophiliac child abuser. And I said, well, Bill, did that make you stop believing in Christianity? He said, no. He said, I understand the messengers, you know, contain the full range of human beings from heroic to terrible, but that doesn't invalidate the message. Love others as you would be loved yourself. Give unto others. If a person strikes you, turn the other cheek, and so forth. The message remains, in Bill's view, very valid. But I think one lesson out of the child abuse, well, two lessons out of it. I do write about this in the book, but it's not something that I can claim to have any deep, profound, unique insight into. But two lessons. One is, no human being is safe with absolutely unscrutinized power over another human being. Almost the only time we ever allow that is a parent with a child. But I think the temptation to misuse power is just so great that no human being is really fit to be given unscrutinized power over someone else. And
is there some connection there then to the hierarchical nature of power in the church?
There probably is, but the other thing is, and this is no plea of mitigation for the church, this terrible syndrome of abuse is very widespread across institutions and across families. I think we are living now in an epidemic of both child abuse and spousal abuse, and it's happening in families. So I'm not for a moment exempting the church from all of its terrible failings, but I don't know that it is uniquely caused by that. So the other reflection I was going to offer was this. Two things happened in culture which I think were very unhelpful. One is we live in a kind of hypersexualized culture now, and I think that's very difficult for people to cope with generally. The other thing is that from about the 50s or 60s, but maybe much earlier than that, a lot of Christians themselves lost the sense of the sacred. Now, I write about a couple of priests in this book. There's one wonderful Irish philosopher, Brendan Purcell, who helped me immensely in the book. Wonderful, brilliant academic philosopher, but at heart really an Irish lout, and therefore a tremendous help in writing this book. Great sense of humour and a great guy and so on. But in one of his books, he describes a moment when he loses faith in the sacred nature of everything that he's doing. So he doesn't believe the Mass any longer involves a dialogue with God. He doesn't believe that his life has any worth. His whole life has been devoted to these spiritual matters, and he suddenly thinks it's all been an empty sham. And that is a moment of utter terror for him, utter existential, personal, psychological terror. Now, I think the priestly life, if it loses the sense of the sacred, best thing for the priest to try to recover the sense of the sacred, and if he can't, to leave the priesthood, just to leave. Because to be in that environment without a sense of the sacred is, I think, very dangerous.
I have a great respect for tradition and a sense of the sacred. I've cried when they pulled the Ponsford stand down, Greg. But I think one thing that I think I can safely say so many other people cannot understand, I will never understand, is to say that, it's right that, any offending towards children should be reported to the police, but in the next breath to suggest that Catholic priests being compelled to break the confessional is somehow prejudiced against Catholics. That to me, nothing is more sacred than the safety of a child. Nothing can be more godly than the idea of that being the most sacred thing that any adult person can do.
Well, I agree with that, but I don't think breaking the seal of the confessional helps you in any way. So you've got to...
But what about, a doctor's seal? Is that different? Why
is it
different?
What about a lawyer's seal? So the Royal Commission, for example, says that lawyers should be able to... So you can be a serial sex offender and the lawyer who's representing you in a trial, you can say, and by the way, I could tell you a lot of other things too, but the lawyer's confident. But look, that's not the way I want to approach this issue at all. I don't think breaking the seal helps you. I think you've got to deal with reality here. Almost no Catholics go to confession now. I haven't been to confession for decades and decades and decades. It barely exists as a practice. And under canon law, and of course I don't write about this in the book because it's not a Catholic book. It's a book about Christianity arguing from first principles. And perfectly legitimate for people to have a different view of this from me and for the government, the legislature to overrule. So the book is not remotely concerned with this, but just to give you my view of it.
You do mention it, though, in the
book. Yeah, I do mention it. But to give you my view of it, almost no Catholics go to confession anymore. The idea of a priest being alone with a kid is long since gone, so it has to be in full view. When I used to go to confession as a kid, the class from the school would go, and we'd go in one after another to a box which had penitents on either side. The teacher was there and the priest was in the middle in his own box. Now, as I understand it, I'm not really a great expert on this. Under canon law, the priest is actually not supposed to know the identity of the person making the confession. So I'm so old that when I went to confession as a young bloke, the priest would open a grill and his face would be hidden by a curtain and my face would be hidden by a curtain. And then if I, you know, was a bit embarrassed about the things that I'd done, I'd make a generic sort of confession. I'd say I sinned against the sixth commandment or something. Now, I just don't think the... Now, there are lots of priests who've talked about this. Frank Brennan, for example, who said that in his entire life, no one has ever remotely confessed anything like that to him. I guess there is a one in a million chance that some bloke may confess, and a priest, of course, would not grant absolution unless the bloke convinced the priest of restitution, amendment of behaviour, all the rest of it. And there might therefore be a one in a million chance that a priest gets to help a guy. But I don't think that this will make... See, it's one of those things, typical issue in our society now, it's symbolic. It will have no application in real life.
Is it frustrating then that people hang on to these things? I mean, the other really obvious one to me is the idea of the Christian welcoming of the stranger, which I think you point out is 36 times mentioned in the Old Testament, that this is such a part of Christianity, and yet people can so easily then attack Christianity if it doesn't look, and particularly Christians in the Parliament, which gets back to what we were talking about before, of them not wanting to speak of it. For example, the situation we have with refugees, which I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure the World Council of Churches has remarked upon Australia's relationship with refugees. These things become easy. Are they easy points of attack, do you think, for Christians at the moment?
I don't think so, because all the Australian churches are massively pro-refugee. You know, there's a big sign on St Paul's Anglican Cathedral, welcome refugees. The Catholic bishop's statements are explicit. Nobody is more pro-refugee than Pope Francis. But let me offer you this reflection.
So how do we keep getting these Christian leaders that... How does that... It is hard to reconcile.
Well, let me offer you this reflection. A lot of things, the further you are away from them, the more black and white they look, and the closer you get to them, the more granular and difficult they are. Who's that... Aristotle... who's that fabulous Greek background Melbourne guy who works with refugees? Anyway, his name will come. Paris Aristotle.
Yes.
So he has the most finely grained and nuanced view of this. And I've spent a lot of time with him about this. So I first got involved in politics by championing the cause of Vietnamese refugees, Vietnamese, Laos and Cambodians. I thought they were genuinely fleeing persecution in communism, and we had been their military allies in the Vietnam War, and we had profound specific debts to them, and we had a general obligation to welcome the stranger. But people who are now regarded as heroes in that period didn't behave much differently from we're behaving now. So Malcolm Fraser acted very quickly to make sure nobody came directly to our shores and that they were all processed in Southeast Asia and that we took a certain number that we approved of. And under Fraser, we took far, far fewer refugees than we took under John Howard. And when I got deeply involved in the issue, I found that there is a genuine problem of the unintended consequences of an open borders policy, which relies on a lot of people drowning at sea, which results in a lot of people drowning at sea. But also, there is a legitimate policy question about people gaming the system. And so none of this, of course, figures in the book because, I mean, I'm happy to get in the ring and box about policies, but, you know, that's not what this book is about, you know. But in any event, I think it is a legitimate question for any government to work out how it controls its borders. But at the same time, I think we should have a very big, generous refugee program. I've always been in favour of a much bigger refugee program than we have. And that allows you to pick the people who are most in need and also people who have some connection with Australia? Yeah,
that, no, I'm not asking you to defend that point. It's more a sense that we open up every Australian parliamentary sitting date with Christian prayers. And in saying that, isn't that our parliament saying we place the morals and the ideas of Christianity very high up the order of what we see?
But I think we are a welcoming society in general. I mean, I'm married to someone who's not Caucasian. I've got three sons who aren't Caucasian, and their daily life is not one of racism. And I got a million friends who are refugees, and they've been immensely successful and happy in Australia. I think in general we are. I mean, we're not as good as we should be, but often you say, well, compared to what? You know, show me where it's done that much better. But as I say, this is not stuff that I write about at all.
Let's throw it out to the audience. If you want to ask a question, put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you.
Right. You might want to make passing reference to Bill Hayden. He was on TV last night. And from memory, Pope John Paul, same, and Mother Teresa did have massive crises of faith. But the general question, you support same-sex marriage, even though you're Catholic, because I understand you believe render to Caesar what is his and render to God what is God. But shouldn't this question be above all that, because God is the creator of a person with a man and woman to have a normal or a relationship, and your conscience really can't go above that?
Look, that's a fair question, and it's not an issue that I canvass in the book at all. But yes, it's true. I advocated a yes vote in the plebiscite, and I don't ask the churches to change their teaching. But I do believe, and I was consoled in researching this book to read that both St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas both held that the civil law should not enforce all elements of the moral law, and that you can't expect the civil law to reflect the moral law in all respects. Now, I'm not remotely equating same-sex marriage with prostitution, but in both their cases, they both said, don't make prostitution illegal because you'll just criminalise an inevitable activity in human society. I'm not remotely equating same-sex marriage with that, but the principle that they argued, which is the civil law cannot enforce the moral law. Now, I do believe we are living in a post-Christian society, and there is not a social consensus to justify laws like that. I also think that, you know, gay people being in love with each other and committed to each other is a good thing. And if gay couples are allowed to adopt children as they are, then it's better for the kids if the two parents are in a long-term, monogamous, committed relationship. So, you know, here I am, the Savonarola, the scourge of shocking orthodoxy, and yet I disagreed. And lots of my Christian friends wrote to me and said, you know, your position is very disappointing, blah, blah, blah. But there it is, you know, who knows? I could be wrong.
Sean Ryan, just an aside, I think God created homosexuals as well. But anyway.
Sure.
I was going to ask you about Dawkins and his ilk. Why are they so bitter, in my perception, in promoting atheism, do you think?
That's a very good question, and it doesn't have a good answer. Now, amongst the new atheists, the one that I like the best by far is the late Christopher Hitchens. I mean, a lot of the things Christopher Hitchens writes about Christianity are pretty silly. You know, he thinks Martin Luther King wasn't really a Christian. Well, Martin Luther King thought he was really a Christian. I don't see how Christopher Hitchens knows better than Martin Luther King what Martin Luther King thought. He doesn't like Mother Teresa's, you know, medical facilities in Calcutta, to which you're inclined to say, well, Christopher, you're a very fine guy, but how many homeless, diseased, distressed people in Calcutta did you personally minister to? I'm sure Mother Teresa could have done better, but she did a bit better than you or I have done. Nonetheless, I like Christopher Hitchens' general attitude. He is a rough and tumble journalist. He gets in the ring, throws a few punches, absorbs a few punches, sees where it lands. He's read a lot of books. He's talked to a lot of people. There it is. Dawkins, on the other hand, seems to consider himself the infallible pope of atheism. And he makes all these infallible statements. His statements are astonishingly bitter and often very silly. He says, for example, the God of the Old Testament is a misogynist, racist, homophobic, genocidal, control freak, you know, with no redeeming features, blah, blah, blah. To which the great Rabbi Jonathan Sacks responded, if that is the God of the Jewish people, if that is what you think is the God of the Jewish people, what do you think of the Jewish people? And Sacks accused Dawkins of anti-Semitism. Dawkins's reading of the Old Testament always uses an extreme literalism, which almost nobody in either the Jewish or Christian traditions actually adheres to. And then he says, if you don't take Genesis literally, why are we supposed to take the resurrection literally? As though, I mean, this is a sort of primary school argument, as though there is no difference between a poem, an allegory, a myth, and between a history. So in the New Testament, it says Jesus is the door to salvation. So does that mean under Dawkins' reading, we have to think that Jesus was really a door? And you almost can't come to grips with how silly these arguments are. And you think, why, Richard, are you so bitter and vituperative? And I have no idea. I've never met the fella and I don't know, but I found his book. At first, I'd been a bit reluctant to read The New Atheists. I thought maybe they'll say something that'll make me a bit unhappy. But really, when I read them, I thought, what they're doing, they're acting like 18th century Anglican bishops. They're just telling the faithful that their beliefs are sensible without actually offering any substance. That's my view.
I remember thinking with Christopher Hitchens, if there is a heaven, he is going straight there, because I've never read or talked to or heard of anybody that thought about God more than him. And that if that's what God wants to be thought of, Christopher Hitchens really put in the hours. One more.
Greg, thank you for your answer about refugees. I was the person who suggested that the sign on the cathedral should be put there. And I agree with a great much of what you've said. But the bit that you didn't address for me was that endless detention of refugees, that is, using and abusing them in order to justify and maintain some sense of security. And also the commentary from various politicians that, of course, we're not now talking theory. We know how to stop the boats. That is, we've found one way. But at dreadful cost. It's immoral what we do to use people like that.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I'm opposed to endless detention too. I agree. That's beyond the scope of my book, but I certainly agree with that. Yeah.
I would see that as a point where Christianity has to enter and call for something much better, and given the resources of the country that we have, a much better approach could in fact be devised and implemented.
We might just leave that one there, because I think he has really talked about that, and we'll have one more really quick one there, and we'll have to leave it there.
Yeah, Marx, who was an old atheist, as you know, said religion is the opium of the people. But he also said that religion is the heart of a heartless world, the sigh of the oppressed creature. And as long as you had oppressive systems, namely capitalism in his era, that you would have people who would turn to religion. And given that we live in a world that, according to an Oxfam report, 8 men have as much wealth as half the world's population, is capitalism a heartless world?
Well, I think the human condition is just full of, full of challenge and difficulty and misery. I'm not a big fan of Marx, I'd have to tell you. That's probably a bit of a revelation, really. People have, read me all these years, they thought, well, there's obviously a heavy Marxist influence there. I found very little that's insightful in Marx. I think his economics is crazy and his metaphysics are just mad. And he's quite a good journalist, lovely turner of phrases. Very dangerous to let journalists have power, of course. So capitalism is neither good nor bad in a sense. I mean, certainly we should try to civilise capitalism. Absolutely, I completely agree with that. Socialism is neither good nor bad. I don't think you can judge socialism by the experience of the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, you know, 20 or 30 million people died as a direct result of state policy under Stalin, many of them executed after terrible torture, and there was a system of slave camps, the gulags. But Marx's proposition that religion is just the sigh of the oppressed and just comes about because of exploitation, it's not logical in it on its face, because that presupposes you can have a human condition which does not involve any exploitation. So first of all, it's an unfalsifiable proposition. So Marx was all about scientific materialism, and yet all of his propositions are unfalsifiable. You cannot falsify them. You can never find. And of course, what he wrote about Asia was just kind of bananas, you know, the Asiatic economy and so forth. But more than that, it does seem to be in the very DNA of humanity, this hunger for God and this belief in God. So all of our primary desires correspond to a primary reality. We get hungry, that implies food. Even if you woke up with deep amnesia and you couldn't remember one thing, you'd get hungry, and that would imply food. And it's not only physical things. We get lonely, and that implies friendship. We feel we've done the wrong thing, and that implies the right thing, the existence of right and wrong. If you look at the burial sites of the earliest human beings that we can identify definitely as human beings, we see ritual, we see artifacts that they were going to take into the next life with them. And indeed, Roger Scruton, wonderful writer, don't agree with him about everything. One of his lovely books is called The Soul of the World. And he argues in The Soul of the World that the most important argument in favour of the existence of God is none of the rational arguments, you know, from design or Thomas Aquinas' five proofs or anything like that. Even the statistical unlikeliness of the university in life, all of that, none of that is the big argument for Roger Scruton. For Roger Scruton, the argument for the existence of God is the sustained, irreducible, ineradicable human experience of God. And that, I think, transcends economic systems, transcends society. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party has been working for many decades to create an atheist society. There are now more Christians in China than there are members of the Chinese Communist Party. Christianity is on fire in China. Now, you can say it's the sigh of the oppressed, because people are certainly oppressed in China, but you can look at any prehistoric society, you find religious belief. I think it's in the nature of humanity, and that's why I think if we banish God, we lose something of our own humanity. But as I say, I could be wrong.
Yeah, I reckon you could be right too. And that was lovely. There was something in the tone of that last answer that is in the book, because it is. I think I said at the outset, there's something very moving about joyful and deeply truthful, obviously, from what you are writing from yourself about this book. So it's also in the top 10 bestsellers, and not just like readings, Carlton, thank you, readings, but like, you know, you include Harry Potter and all the gardening books and cookbooks, and this is selling like hotcakes. So I can really recommend it. I've really enjoyed reading it. It's made me want to go back to having a look at particularly the Book of Ruth again. And Greg, it's just such a pleasure for you to come in here and share all of this with us. Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, Sally.
Greg Sheridan.
Sally Warhaft and Greg Sheridan talking about Christianity Today for the Fifth Estate live at the Wheeler Centre. Next up, former Foreign Affairs Minister Stephen Smith on Foreign Affairs. Subscribe to the Fifth Estate podcast at wheelercentre.com and book yourself a ticket to our next live event while you're there. Until next time, take care.